I guess it's been a couple of years since we chatted last. You look good. You gave up cigarette smoking.
True. True. Good for you to remember that. To note.
You were chain smoking, as I recall. And, everybody stops one way or the other.
Yeah. Well, I was stopped at the gunpoint, more or less.
At the gunpoint?
Of my wife.
Good for her.
Yeah.
So what have you been doing the past 2 years?
Writing and erasing, especially erasing. You know, I don't really like to be called a writer. I'm an eraser or a chiseler. Everyone can write.
I didn't quite catch it. An eraser?
An eraser and a chiseler. Chiseling away. Everyone can write. I write easily. But most of my working time I spend on erasing, changing around, and chiseling away. I work like a sculptor, rather. That is, I note a certain block of granite out there in the mountain, which I decipher some sort of a shape. I drag it to my studio and I start chiseling away, which takes me some years. When this is over, I just put in a magnifying glass and work with a tiny pair of scissors, removing particles, you know, punctuations, adjectives, adverbs. That's when I feel terribly sorry for myself, because I know no one would ever notice unless it's very wrong, unless I do it wrong.
It's interesting that the last time we had talked, you made reference to A Perfect Peace. You'd actually finished the novel at that time, hadn't you?
Yes, it was published already in Hebrew, but it took a long time to travel into English.
Last time we chatted also, we talked quite a bit about the problem in translating. The translation process, of course, for A Perfect Peace is over. You've had a chance to sit down and read it. The last time we chatted, you had told me of some clashes that you'd had with your various translators because of sometimes they didn't grasp the idiom. Have you sat down to read the English version from the front?
Yes, I've
back?
Recently read it cover to cover in English. It's a strange experience, I tell you. It's like listening to a violin concerto played on the piano. It can be done, by the way. It can be done beautifully, as long as the translator is not trying to make the piano make the sounds of the violin, which is grotesque. In other words, I keep telling all my various translators, for God's sake, be very unfaithful in order to be loyal.
In other words, you're saying don't be too literal.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's the shortest way to total ruination of a work.
As you read A Perfect Peace in English translation, did it feel like it was your book? Did you recognize it as something, gee, I wrote this?
You know, I felt about it the way I feel about my elder children. They are mine, and yet they are their own. They are my own flesh and blood, and yet they are different. It's interesting that certain pages in this book overwhelmed me in English, in the way of being, in a sense, better than I thought they were. Probably enriched by English idiom. Probably estranged from me by traveling into a different language. Probably giving me at long last a kind of perspective which painters can easily have by stepping back from the canvas, and which writers hardly ever manage to get because we work with our noses stuck to the canvas.
I thought it read very, very well. I thought it read very easily. But it would be very interesting if I were to be able to read Hebrew. It would be very interesting to read both versions and have some comprehension about the changes.
That would have been fun. Well, learn Hebrew.
No. The day is gone that I'm going to pick up a new language, I think. I have a hard enough time just trying to stay abreast of English.
Well,
in A Perfect Peace, you write about the goings-on of a family on a kibbutz. And this took place in the mid-1960s, as I recall.
Right.
You were 14 when you entered a kibbutz. Had your family lived in a kibbutz prior to your joining one?
Oh, never. On the contrary, my folks were middle-class, right-wing city dwellers. Consequently, when I rebelled, I became a left-wing, or hoped to become a left-wing socialist peasant, farmhand. Of course, like most rebels, mine was a full circle as well, because what my father secretly wished for me is to become a cross between Nimrod the Hunter, a tough, simple Israeli soldier farmer, and a good Jewish scholar. And here I ended up, after 30 years or so, carrying a gun, watching over the settlement, occasionally driving a tractor, and yet sitting in a room full of books and writing yet more books, which is exactly what my father had prescribed for me.
I have a feeling that in A Perfect Peace, Azariah is much like you were when you entered the kibbutz. Is that a correct assumption?
All my sons, or my brothers, or myself, if I can say so, if I would have written a novel about the first Albanian astronaut landing on the moon, it would still be a very autobiographical novel. Azariah is indeed very close to what I was at some point in my life. His spiritual twin brother and rival, Yonatan, is very close to what I have been at some other point in my life. So are the old folks in this novel, and so is everybody.
Well, Azariah certainly had all the answers, and I suppose that when you are a young man, we have more answers than we have questions. I know when I was in my teens, I certainly had all the answers.
Yes. Well, this Azariah would cut a much better interviewer than I am, because he really has more answers than questions. Moreover, he is tailoring his questions according to his ready-made answers. But then there is something, at least to me, very moving about this ridiculous clown of a messiah, a joke of a redeemer, a world reformer who cannot even tie his own shoelaces.
You have lived in a kibbutz all of your years since your early teens, is that correct?
Basically, yes. I took a few breaks. I spent a sabbatical year abroad at one point in my life, and then again in another point in my life. But I've been a member of that particular kibbutz, Hulda, for 30 years now.
With that knowledge, and knowing that you were teaching this past year in Colorado College,
right?
What was it like going to from the kibbutz, finding yourself at Colorado College? Presumably, I've never been there, but presumably a much different existence, a much different world.
Well, I wanted it. I opted for it. In terms of my own writing, I needed to get as far as I could from kibbutz and Israel. And Colorado is pretty much the further possible point on Earth, not only in geographical terms. I even needed to get as far as I could from my own language, from Hebrew, in order to write yet another Hebrew novel set in Israel, which I more or less did.
You are no longer teaching there, Colorado.
No, I just finished my teachings. I'm now a full-time writer in residence.
At Colorado?
With the Colorado College, yes.
You are still a full-time?
I'm still a full-time writer in residence for the next 2 months or so.
2 months?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Then back to Israel.
Then back to Israel. Well, tell me what it's like. Was there a cultural shock when you arrived in the... Is it the mountains or whatever it's like in Colorado?
Nothing like a shock. Yes. I had a very, very soft landing. In fact, it's a dramatic change of atmosphere, literally atmosphere and spiritually. It's a very relaxed part of America. And in a strange way, in a funny way, it's one of the least alien places where I had ever visited. People are open, forthcoming, friendly, warm, much like my own folks back in Israel.
You taught creative writing?
Well, that is a must. I mean, every visiting writer is supposed to give one of those courses in creative writing, but I secretly turned that one into a course in slow reading. That is, rather than teach my students how to write, I tried to teach them how to read. Very slowly, as opposed to the popular courses in fast reading.
I was talking to William Gass, who is a writer and a creative writing professor at Washington University in St. Louis. He told me something very interesting in line with what you said, to read and to read slowly. There are some books that do not allow themselves to be rushed. because of the way it is written, the books are written, and to speed up some works of art, some books, would be like trying to speed up Mozart. Mm-hmm. These are things that you just can't do, and you could speed up Mozart, but somehow it doesn't work, and the art is destroyed. I don't know, is that in line with what you were saying?
Very much so, except that where Gus compared it to Mozart, I'd compare it to lovemaking. Why should one speed it up?
Won't get any argument from me. I have a feeling you fit in pretty well, and you seem to speak in such a way that must have been a positive experience for you.
I had a very joyful year over there, a very relaxed one, and I'm exceedingly grateful to whoever invited me there, but also grateful to myself for accepting the invitation.
Did you have your family with you?
Part of my family, my wife and my younger son.
Are you looking forward to going back?
Yeah.
To Israel, I mean.
Naturally.
What about your duties on the kibbutz? They have changed, of course, over the years, particularly as you have established yourself as a writer. Because it's been, been a year since you've been there. But what happens when you go back? Are you thinking to have a ticker tape parade for you and say, here's your room and your typewriter, get with it, or what? What's going to happen?
My room is waiting for me. My typewriter traveled all the way to the Rocky Mountains. I have my part-time job as a kibbutz teacher. And yes, I have my regular duties as an occasional kibbutz dining hall waiter and as a kibbutz night watchman. A couple of duties in picking apples or weeding cotton, that's the usual. But it's all set in a very flexible way and on a family basis. That is, if I feel like shut myself away and do nothing but write for a while, everybody won't understand. Assuming that in between one writing project and the next, I devote most of my time to teaching and weeding cotton. It's a very relaxed arrangement.
You're still, of course, turning over your royalties to the kibbutz.
To the very happy treasurer. But then I still approach the very unhappy treasurer whenever I need to go and stay in a hotel in the other end of the country and shut myself and write. All I have to do is to tell him what's the sum of money I need, and he will twist his lips, but write down the check without looking the book into the books to see how much have I recently earned for the community. It's a very familial arrangement.
A Perfect Peace, of course, is a novel, and your previous, the last book published in the United States was a nonfiction book in which you spent a lot of time crisscrossing Israel to sample opinion about things, and you made some conclusions for yourself. 2 years have passed, maybe more, actually, since you took that trip. Have you noticed any major changes in attitudes and approaches in Israel since the time you wrote that book?
I've been away from Israel for 10 months now. That's probably the equivalent of being away from America for 5 years, you know. Like currency, our time is inflated and speeded up. But yes, I would say that sound and fury, which typified the most heated days of the Lebanon War, the days in which I gather the interviews for In the Land of Israel, had somewhat relaxed. The country is more sad and thoughtful now than it was a couple of years ago. Sad and thoughtful. I think the ultimate results of the Israeli invasion into Lebanon taught all of us a painful and very expensive lesson about the limitations of military power. Not the redundancy of military power, not the uselessness of military power, but precisely the limitations of military power.
Now, there are limitations, but you were not necessarily opposed to taking the military action that seemed to be necessary to push the PLO gunmen back and away from the borders, are you?
I'm a peacenik, not a pacifist. If I had to squeeze my conviction into a couple of formula, which I don't particularly enjoy to do, I would say the following. The Lebanon War was a gross overreaction. I believe that a partial threat or a limited threat should have been met by limited military measures rather than by a full-scale war.
Well, I don't know about that, because I follow events that happen in Lebanon, that is a country that looks hopeless.
Indeed.
There are so many religious sects, mm-hmm. each armed mm-hmm. with guns, fighting each other, mm-hmm. slaughtering each other. The government cannot control mm-hmm. them. It's a country that is a example of anarchy, probably the worst example of anarchy, or the best example of anarchy in the world today. And I don't know what to do about Lebanon except to seal it off, just have a wall around it.
At least I do know what not to do. You can't step into your neighbor's house in order to put it in order.
But there was a domestic threat for mm-hmm. Israel from mm-hmm. these people that were crossing the border and shelling across the border. And all
which should have justified a limited, thoughtful, calculated, balanced military measure rather than launching a full-scale war and attempting to establish a new order in a neighboring country.
Well, you certainly are involved politically. Have you ever thought about, or have you ever run for office or thought about running for office?
Perish the thought. I'm not the kind of character who could move around saying no comment to anything. I happen to have a comment to everything under the sun, which disqualifies me as a politician forever.
I don't know. I could see here in New York, I could see her saying Prime Minister Oz today said such and such, and no comment from Prime Minister Oz, and, you know, it could be wonderful. You could give us all sorts of non-quotes.
It's the non-comment stuff which defeats me. I can't even refrain from commenting on your non-comment example, you see.
No chance you might hold a parliamentary seat, huh?
No, I have, in fact, turned down some propositions or pulls leaving from friends and, I believe, from secret enemies to run for office.
Well,
no, nobody would write my stories for me, you know.
Well,
Israel has 4 million citizens, 4 million potential prime ministers, but my stories are to be written by myself or by no one else.
Well, you're about to wrap up your stay in the United States. Within 2 months, you'll be back home. And so I guess my last question to you would be to kind of give me a capsule look ahead. What is going to be happening to you after you get back, and what is in your future?
Now you expect me to prophesy. That's a very tricky business coming from the land of the prophets. You know, there is a lot of competition. I guess I'll go on writing political articles for Rage and making angry hit-and-run political appearances. I will not step into politics. I'd not run for office. I'd work on another novel. I'd stick to my basic position, which is that of a witness, hopefully an honest witness, to the Israeli drama. A kind of witness which I tried to be as I wrote A Perfect Peace, the kind of witness which I tried to be in each and every one of my works. You know, in a place where everyone is in action, someone should stand somewhat away in Colorado, perhaps, or mentally in Colorado, watch the scene and report.
Are you going to take back news of America and what you learned here over the past year?
Indeed, and if you interview me in 10 years from now, I'll give you a detailed report about my American memoir. I'm a very slow writer. Otherwise, I'd be in your business. Perhaps I'd be a journalist. This book, A Perfect Peace, is set in the 60s. The novel I'm working on now is set in the 70s. So by the mid-90s, I may write something about my present experiences in Colorado.
Well, we'll hobble to the microphone and get together at that time. It was really great having you back. Incidentally, when you adopted your Hebrew name, what does it mean exactly? And what does it mean to you?
Well, literally, the name Oz means strength, courage, daring, which is exactly what I needed very badly when I left home at 15 or so to go and live on my own in a kibbutz. So it was a kind of a wishful thinking name.
And Amos, how that
that
become
was given
part of
me by my genuine parents.
That is your real name?
That's my very real name, yes.
Well, I want to thank you very much for coming back and talking to me. I hope that you've enjoyed your stay in the United States. When you come back, I hope we'll be able to get together and chat some more.
Thank you. That's a deal.